Today is Sunday, the 19th of July, 2009. When John asked me to give this talk, I sort of half-seriously asked a few people who were out at Chapin Mill what they'd like me to talk about. And one person said, talk about how to respond to the economic downturn. Another person said, talk about anything, but don't talk about how to respond to the economic downturn. And then another person said, people like something topical, don't talk about the old masters. So we're going to take up an old master and relate his teaching somewhat to the difficulties that people are facing in the economic downturn, but also beyond that, hopefully, to just difficulties in general, painful things that we have to deal with. And the old master is about as venerable as you can get. It's Bodhidharma. And this is a quite a short piece called Outline of Practice. And it appears in a number of places. The translation that we'll be working from is from the Zen Teaching of Bodhidharma by Red Pine. But also it appears in a little book called Zen Dawn by Thomas Cleary. And it's a very early text. It was rediscovered in the Donghuang caves in the 20th century. It's part of a thing called the Records of the Lanka, the very earliest of the Zen teachers. And it dates back to the first half of the 8th century. And we're going to be reading basically from Red Pine's translation, but sometimes I'm going to be throwing in a bit of the Cleary one because sometimes I think it's a little more helpful and clearer on that. So I won't always be crediting Cleary, but I'll be switching back and forth a little bit. So this has got really five sections, and we'll look at each of these. This is the first one. Many roads lead to the path, but basically there are only two, reason and practice. To enter by reason means using the teachings to awaken to the source. It means to believe that all living things share the same true nature, which isn't apparent because it's shrouded by sensation and delusion. Those who turn from delusion back to reality, who meditate on walls, the absence of self and other, the oneness of mortal and sage, and who remain unmoved even by scriptures, are in complete and unspoken agreement with reason. Without moving, without effort, they enter, we say, by reason. Okay, so this is the first of these two roads which Bodhidharma lays out for us in his outline of practice. So when he says many roads lead to the path, of course he's talking about the great way, the Tao. But basically there are only two, reason and practice. Now when he says reason here, he means our deepest reason. Not logical thinking, but you could say our good sense or our basic sanity. Cleary translates this as inner truth. To enter by means of our inner truth. So in this first one, it's not surprising that Bodhidharma might be talking about Zazen, about awakening to the source. The essence of this is having faith that we all share the same true nature and that it's just a matter of uncovering it. It gets covered up by our delusive thinking. So the essence of our Zazen is turning away from that delusion and back to reality. It says, those who turn from delusion back to reality, who meditate on walls. Now, this is probably a reference to his Bodhidharma's 9 years facing a war. And there's a footnote in the Red Pine which says, Bodhidharma's walls of emptiness connect all opposites, including self and other, mortal and sage. You could also understand these walls as being our delusion. We actually, instead of kind of denying our delusion, we sit and face the wall, we face our limits, and then by really facing them, we can see through them, and then we see that they are unreal. And reality is revealed. It talks about people being unmoved even by scriptures. And again, this is the basic Zen teaching that we have to go beyond the written word that we inherit and find out for ourselves what the truth is. He says, without moving, without effort, they enter. We say by reason, by inner truth. So this is very basic. We'll come back to this later. But then he sets out four other practices which are more related to our everyday life outside the Zendo. He calls them four all-inclusive practices. So this is covering the whole gamut of practice. And he calls these suffering injustice, adapting to conditions, seeking nothing, and practicing the Dharma. So let's have a look at each of these. First, suffering and injustice. Here's what Bodhidharma says. When those who search for the path encounter adversity, they should think to themselves, in countless ages gone by, I've turned from the essential to the trivial and wandered through all manner of existence, often angry without cause, and have thereby caused much harm. Now, though I do no wrong, I'm punished by my past. Neither gods nor men can foresee when an unskillful deed will bear its fruit. I accept it with an open heart and without complaint of injustice. The sutras say, when you meet with adversity, don't be upset because it makes sense. With such understanding, you're in harmony with reason, with inner truth. And by suffering injustice, you advance on the path. I think, pick up some examples here of this. One that probably everybody has noticed is the Dalai Lama's acceptance of the exile of the Tibetan people without rancor. It's really quite extraordinary. That doesn't mean that he doesn't do everything in his power to change the attitude of the Chinese, to try and get them to stop repressing the Tibetan people, but he accepts the fact of the present exile, the present repression of the Tibetan people. And I've heard him actually say, this is the effects of our karma, ripened karmic seeds. Another example from the sutras, it's the story of Angulimala, who was a serial killer who, when he met the Buddha, had murdered 99 people. He became a monk, and later on, when he was out going on his alms rounds, some people recognized him as Angulimala and beat him up very, very badly. And he managed to get back to the wherever the monks were staying, and they cleaned him up and gave him a new robe and everything. But the Buddha commented at that time, enduring suffering in love and awareness can erase the bitter hatred of a thousand lifetimes. Angulimala got his karmic seeds ripened within his lifetime, that when he had actually committed these crimes. But that's not always the case, according to the teaching. It could be in the next life, or it can be in any life after that. Another example that came up about a year ago was with one of our members who lost his job. He was working for a finance company, and this finance company was one of the early victims of the downturn. A lot of different finance companies that provided loans for property folded in Auckland, New Zealand. And this was the third time he'd been made redundant since he moved to New Zealand. And he felt that there was an element of racism involved. He was a recent immigrant, and in these different jobs he witnessed his getting laid off before other people who had come after him who were New Zealand born. And this was very painful for him. We actually were very sad to see him and his wife go. They couldn't get work in Auckland, and they had to return to their home country where she could get her old job back that she'd had before she came. So they couldn't do much about this racism, and I don't doubt that there was an element of that there. But they couldn't. If they'd stayed, perhaps there was something they could have done. But really, because they were leaving, there wasn't much. So holding on to his anger about it wasn't going to be so helpful. It would just perpetuate the pain of this having happened. So this is an example where just recognizing, well, I must have sowed some seeds at some point that led to this injustice, and then just moving on. It's important, though, that we understand what we're saying when we talk about karmic seeds. The term in the teaching is actually karma vipaka. Karma means the cause, vipaka the effect. So really, when we have something like this happen, we should say, oh, this is my vipaka, rather than this is my karma. This natural law has nothing to do with reward and punishment. Very important to understand this. There's no place here for guilt. It's not like we have to say, oh, I really must have been bad to deserve this, and then feel guilty about it. Because you're not the same person now that you were when you sowed the seed. Angulimala wasn't. He'd repented of what he had done and abandoned his hatred and aggression. He was a different person when he had to suffer the consequence of his previous actions. So that we don't have to feel guilty. We just have to recognize, okay, now I'm paying an old debt. And it's not like that debt is to the person that you hurt in the past. That person you hurt in the past is now different, has changed, may have gone completely, or very likely. Even if they're still alive, they're still not the same person as they were when you hurt them. The debt is really to ourselves. When we do something unskillful, we're limiting ourselves. We're acting out of a narrow mind. That's the debt that we're paying. Because as we know, there's no other. There's nobody outside. Because this teaching does bring up the thorny issue of rebirth, and some people have trouble with it. It's not something we can get into in this talk, but I would recommend that you, if it is an issue for you, that you get hold of Sante Sensei's new book, The Net of Indra, where he really lays out a lot of the reasons why we might have trouble with accepting the teaching of rebirth, and also a lot of evidence about why it's not so strange. The Buddhist teaching is that we die and are reborn in each moment. And yet, this is the nature of the skandhas, the elements that make up a human being, the mind and the body, the elements of the mind and the body, that these skandhas are like five rivers that flow. They're always changing, always flowing. So there's nothing permanent there, and yet we continue somehow. There is this continuity. And that goes for within this moment and between now and the next life. I do think that without a belief in rebirth, it's hard to have perspective on what we're doing in practice, because we really do need the long view if we take the four vows seriously. Think of the last one, the great way of Buddha I vow to attain. The great way of Buddha is complete, perfect enlightenment. Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. We're vowing, every time we do the four vows, we're vowing to attain Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. Are we really going to do it in this lifetime? It's a pretty tall order. Really, really, the important thing about this first practice, the suffering and injustice, is doing what we can about injustice, but accepting what we can't do anything about. It's a beautiful story in this book by Christina Feldman and Jack Kornfield, Stories of the Spirit, Stories of the Heart, which is about this the essential teaching here, the teaching of acceptance. And this account is written by somebody called Rachel Naomi Remen, and she works with people who've suffered major losses. Here's what she says. As a physician, I had a man come into my practice with bone cancer. His leg was removed at the hip to save his life. He was 24 years old when I started working with him, and he was a very angry man with a lot of bitterness. He felt a deep sense of injustice and a very deep hatred for all well people, because it seemed so unfair to him that he had suffered this terrible loss so early in life. I worked with this man through his grief and rage and pain, using painting, imagery, and deep psychotherapy. After working with him for more than 2 years, there came a profound shift. He began coming out of himself. Later, he started to visit other people who had suffered severe physical losses, and he would tell me the most wonderful stories about these visits. Once, he visited a young woman who was almost his own age. It was a hot day in Palo Alto, and he was in running shorts, so his artificial leg showed when he came into her hospital room. The woman was so depressed about the loss of both her breasts that she wouldn't even look at him, wouldn't pay attention to him. The nurses had left her radio playing, probably in order to cheer her up. So, desperate to get her attention, he unstrapped his leg and began dancing around the room on one leg, snapping his fingers to the music. She looked at him in amazement and then burst out laughing and said, "Man, if you can dance, I can sing." It was a year following this that we sat down to review our work together. He talked about what was significant to him, and then I shared what was significant in our process. As we were reviewing our 2 years of work together, I opened his file and there discovered several drawings he had made early on. I handed them to him. He looked at them and said, "Oh, look at this." He showed me one of his earliest drawings. I had suggested to him that he draw a picture of his body. He had drawn a picture of a vase, and running through the vase was a deep black crack. This was the image of his body, and he had taken a black crayon and had drawn the crack over and over again. He was grinding his teeth with rage at the time. It was very, very painful, because it seemed to him that this vase could never function as a vase again. It could never hold water. Now, several years later, he came to this picture and looked at it and said, "Oh, this one isn't finished." And I said, extending the box of crayons, "Why don't you finish it?" He picked a yellow crayon and, putting his finger on the crack, he said, "You see here where it is broken? This is where the light comes through." And with the yellow crayon, he drew light streaming through the crack in his body. We can grow strong at the broken places. I wonder if this is the source of that Leonard Cohen song, or the other way around, perhaps. But one of the important points to note in this story is the gap. The gap between that first drawing, that drawing of utter desolation, of feeling completely broken and unrepairable, to the time where he could, with joy, add that light streaming through. We want to skip that drawing of the vase with the crack in it and get to the light coming through. But it's not something we can rush. We have to be prepared to feel that desolation. Second practice, Bodhidharmas, adapting to conditions. And here the translation in the Cleary version is going along with the causal nexus. As sentient beings, we're ruled by conditions, not by ourselves. All the suffering and joy we experience depend on conditions. If we should be blessed by some great reward, such as fame or fortune, it's the fruit of a seed planted by us in the past. When conditions change, it ends. Why delight in its existence? But while success and failure depend on conditions, the mind neither waxes nor wanes. Those who remain unmoved by the wind of joy silently follow the path. An example of this was one of my students who came to me a few months back, delighted and relieved that she had survived the second round of redundancies at her place of work. We talked about it, and she recognized that there was very likely to be another round later on. and could see that it was better not to get too happy about having escaped having her job cut this time. Because one of our tendencies is that if we have some success or some promotion, a pay rise, we take that to mean that we have special attributes. And when we do that, of course, we're setting ourselves up for disappointment. We think that these circumstances that we have to respond to say something about who we are. This is one side of self-conceit, this notion of self. We feel a little bit arrogant, a little bit special. In Buddhist cosmology, pride is associated with the realms of worldly gods. And in the sutras it says that these gods just live in a state of luxury and ease, but it's impermanent. It's an impermanent state. And at a certain point, the beautiful flower garlands that they wear start to rot and smell. And at that point, they're shunned by the other gods, because, of course, this reminds the other gods of the fact that their world, their ease and pleasure is impermanent. They don't want to be reminded of that. So they will get as far away as possible from the gods who are beginning to stink. Pride comes before a fall. Certainly learn if you do suffer some great loss, wealth, get very ill, you find out who your real friends are. They're the people who are willing to stick with you in your adversity. But we can save ourselves from a lot of heartache if we don't get too proud when good things happen to us. There's a famous Tibetan yogi called Geshe Ben who used to say that his only practice was watching his self-importance bloat up and then crumble down again and again. That was his mindfulness practice, just to see that process. Oh, we get puffed up, something. Oh, yes, the teacher's recognizing what a fine student I am. Of course, you set yourself up right there for feeling awful when you get criticized. You watch that bloating and crumbling. And it's said that he every time he watched his mind crumble, it made him feel freer, gave him pleasure. Because he is recognizing right there the insubstantiality of the self. The student of mine, on the third round of redundancies, she lost her job. And she got notice of that on her birthday. Bodhidharma's third path of practice, seeking nothing. People of this world are deluded. They're always longing for something, always, in a word, seeking. But the wise wake up. They choose reason over custom. Here the other translation has, they choose inner truth over convention. They fix their minds on the sublime and let their bodies change with the seasons. All phenomena are emptied, and there is nothing wished for to take joy in. calamity forever alternates with prosperity. To dwell in the three realms is to dwell in a burning house. To have a body is to suffer. Does anyone with a body know peace? The sutras say, to seek is to suffer. To seek nothing is bliss. When you seek nothing, you're on the path. Just a couple of points about this. When he says calamity forever alternates with prosperity, those two are capitalized and they refer to two goddesses that appear in the Nirvana Sutra. And the three realms here is, again, relates to Buddhist cosmology, the realm of desire, form and formlessness, but it's really just a way of saying all of existence, every kind of existence. Conditioned existence. To dwell in the three realms is to dwell in a burning house. Everything keeps changing. So, again, important to understand what Bodhidharma is saying here. He's not saying do nothing, initiate nothing, just become totally passive. He's not saying that. It's not the kind of seeking he's talking about here. It's a very specific kind of seeking. It's self-seeking. He's talking here about craving, thirst. Really good definition of this. The Pali is tanha, Sanskrit trishna. Good definition of this tanha is seeking private fulfillment of our desires. In other words, seeking fulfillment of our desires even at the expense of others. So it's self-partiality, self-concern that Bodhidharma is addressing here, this kind of seeking. And in hard times, in difficult times, often this is what will come up very strongly. You'll hear it. Certainly it's been appearing in articles that people have written in New Zealand. This is a time when you just got to look out for number one. And it's not like it just comes up in difficult times. If we're honest with ourselves, we'll recognize that this self-concern is what drives probably 99% of our thoughts on and off the mat. There are three kinds of this self-concern. Karma tanha, bhava tanha, and vibhava tanha. Karma tanha is the more obvious one. It's craving for physical comfort, pleasure. That relates to all the senses, pleasant sights, pleasant feelings, good smells and tastes, pleasing sounds, and of course the other side of it, aversion to unpleasant sensations, sights, etc. Also, it's attachment to our thoughts and opinions. These are often the stickiest ones, especially thoughts and opinions that are reassuring, confirming our idea about who we are, comforting, and aversion to thoughts and experiences and ideas that are disturbing and uncomfortable. Bhava tanha is our thirst to exist. So it's what propels us from birth to birth. But it's more than that. It's also within this lifetime, it's our thirst to become what we're not. So our longing to be more attractive than we are, thinner, fitter, more disciplined. Even our longing for awakening can be bhava tanha. If it gives rise to greed and impatience, if it brings us more suffering, in other words, doubts about how we're doing, are we getting it right? jealousy of other people who appear to have more attainments than we do. Getting into self-punishment because we're not doing as well as we think we should. So it's really, really important to be vigilant about this. Are we just getting into bhavatana in our grasping for awakening? And of course our culture, consumer culture, is all about bhavatana. We have a whole economy built on it. Kamatana and bhavatana. We're constantly told to succeed, to achieve, to acquire. And we bring all of this conditioning with us to our Zen practice. We have to understand awakening as a process, not a discrete goal. Not something out there that we, if we acquire, then everything will be all right. Vibhavatana may be even less obvious. This is the longing for non-existence. It's the death wish. Freud recognized these two in his system of psychology. He talked about eros and thanatos. This is the desire to not be what we are. Can manifest itself in self-destructive behavior, like addictions, where our rational mind knows that what we're doing is self-destructive, and yet we keep doing it. But also in just feelings of self-hatred, strong aversion to who we are. The antidote to these two is stopping. To learn to seek nothing for ourselves. When we can do this, even for a moment, it changes everything. One thing it opens up is a recognition that we're part of a community. We're not isolated individuals, but we're part of something. We can shift from seeking to serving. It opens up also all kinds of creativity. I heard a wonderful story from a friend about a city in Brazil where the city government, city leaders, decided that they were going to be sure that no one in their city was hungry. And they did this. They set up community kitchens to cook meals. It wasn't just handing out food stamps to people, but it was actually providing people with good food, good cooked food. They had restaurants, paid restaurants to cook food. Crime went down. Learning improved. This is in the favelas in a Brazilian town. I don't know what the name of the town was. But one of the people involved in this was interviewed afterwards, and she said the worst thing about it was how easy it was. How easy it was to do this. But most of us, we're so caught up in our little drama that we miss these opportunities to actually make a difference. And if there's anything we need in this present crisis, it's to get beyond tanha, the self-seeking, because, of course, the source of this crisis is tanha. It's this impulse in our culture to try and get more out of something than we put in. Whether it's loans being rebundled and sold so the bank can make more money again, give out more loans, or just reselling properties again and again just because the price keeps going up. Not putting anything in and not creating anything, just making money. The final one here, practicing the Dharma. The Dharma is the truth that all natures are pure. By this inner truth, all appearances are empty. Defilement and attachment, subject and object don't exist. The sutras say, the Dharma includes no being because it's free from the impurity of being, and the Dharma includes no self because it's free from the impurity of self. Those wise enough to believe and understand this truth are bound to practice according to the Dharma. And since that which is real includes nothing worth begrudging, they give their body, life, and property in charity, without holding back in the heart, without the vanity of giver, gift, or recipient, and without bias or attachment. And to eliminate impurity, they teach others, but without becoming attached to form. Thus, through their own practice, they're able to help themselves and others and glorify the way of enlightenment. And as with charity, they also practice the other virtues, but while practicing the six virtues to eliminate delusion, they practice nothing at all. This is what's meant by practicing the Dharma. So the essential message in this passage is to do what we do without self-consciousness, without the vanity. And here they take up the example of what he calls charity, but really it's dana, it's the first of the paramitas. The paramitas are the essential aspects of awakening in the bodhisattvic path. So paramita means to the other shore, in other words, to the shore of awakening. And they are dana, giving, sila, skillful behavior, kshanti, patience, virya, devotion, dhyana, meditation, and prajna, wisdom. So here in this passage, Bodhidharma uses dana, the first of the paramitas, but he's basically saying whatever you do, whatever aspect of the path you're practicing, to do it without self-consciousness, to do it without thinking about being the giver, giving the gift to the recipient. In other words, without ideas of self and other. Since that which is real includes nothing worth begrudging, they give their body, life, and property in dana, without holding back in the heart, without the vanity of giver, gift, or recipient, and without bias or attachment. They teach others, but without becoming attached to the form. While practicing the six virtues, they practice nothing at all. Really, to get to this exalted state, because how many of us, how much of the time, really can practice without any thought of self or other, we have to be doing that first practice that he mentioned, the wall gazing. We have to, in an ongoing way, be making this effort to awaken to the source, to awaken to the fact that self and other are just mental constructions. later in this in the Cleary translation of this text, they mention some of the other ways that Bodhidharma taught. And it says, the great teacher Bodhidharma would point to things and ask their meaning. He would just point to say something and say, what is it called? There is a multitude of things, question them all. Interchange their names, and with them changed, question them. This is really our task in Zen, to put a question mark after everything. When we puff up with pride, to put a question mark. Is this really real? When we feel disappointment, to put a question mark. Is this really so bad? Might there be something good that can come out of this? There are good things that can come out of this economic downturn, which of course is our collective karma. We can simplify our lives, and certainly we can connect more with our community, and I don't mean just our Zen community, our Sangha, but the wider community too. Really, there's a lot that can come out of these difficulties, which could be very positive. And there is nothing in the downturn that will prevent us from practicing the six paramitas. In fact, we're likely to have more opportunities to do so. Especially the Kshanti paramita, paramita of patience. All of these paramitas are indispensable aspects of the Bodhisattva path. And yet Kshanti, patience, we can only practice in adversity. Only when things are tough do we get the chance to practice patience. We'll stop here and recite four vows.